All right, good morning, everyone. Let's begin. So I'd like to try to do something a little bit different just for the next 2 weeks, Emir Teshem leading up to Purim, and that's just to focus on a couple of fascinating ideas from the Megillah. And then Emir Teshem, we will actually, surprisingly enough, we'll find a way to tie them back to Tehillim as well, because interestingly enough, one of the ways that the Gemara learns out the concept that we read the Megillah by day and by night is actually from a pasuk in Tehillim. So we'll tie it, we're not totally going off course, but just to focus, I think, on two fascinating ideas that, again, will thematically connect to many things that we saw in Tehillim. So let's begin. We're just going to begin with a little bit of what will appear to be a number of disjointed facts that will turn out to actually come together to paint a very important picture. So the Megillah begins in number 1 the following. Ishu de'ayu abishushan abira. Ushmo Mordechai ben Yoir ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. So there was a Yehudi who was in Shushan Abir, the Shushan, the capital city, and his name was Mordechai, the son of Yoir, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish ish Yemini. Asher Haglom Yerushalayim, who was exiled from Jerusalem, Im Hagolah Asher Haglosa, with the exiles whom were exiled, Im Yechanya Melech Yehuda, who were exiled with Yechanya, the king of Judah, Asher Haglot Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, who were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Bavel. Okay, so the Gemara picks up on a very interesting idea. Mordechai is described in two ways in the Megillah. He's described first how? A Yehudi. And then, at the end of the Pasuk, Ish Yemini. The problem, of course, is what? Yehudi means what? No. From the tribe of Yehuda. Remember, Yehudi, the concept of a Jew being referred to as a Jew, right, as a Yehudi, is a more contemporary idea. Whenever you see in Tanakh that he's referred to as Yehudi, it means from the tribe of Yehuda. Yes?
Yeah, but Binyamin's tribe is located within the tribe
of Yehuda. Oh, so that not within the tribe, next to the tribe. Next to the tribe. Good, we're going to discuss. So now, again, on one hand, he's described as a Yehudi from the tribe of Judah. On the other hand, he's described as a Yemini from the tribe of Binyamin. So remember, as was mentioned, so the tribal areas of Yehuda and Binyamin actually are next to each other. Interestingly enough, where's the border between Yehuda and Binyamin? Right, actually, where? Where? The Mizbeach. The line between Yehuda and Binyamin actually runs right down the Mizbeach. Now, interestingly enough, we know that Yerushalayim does not belong to any one particular Shevet. The Gemara says that Yerushalayim lo nischalka l'shvatim. Jerusalem was not divided up among the tribes. Yerushalayim belongs to everyone. But interestingly enough, the technical border between Yehuda and Binyamin does run right along the ramp of the Mizbeach. So again, even though these tribes are still next to each other, nevertheless, we know that they're still independent tribes. So the Gemara therefore tries to understand, how do we reconcile these ideas? Is he a Yehudi or is he a Yemini? Is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? So the Gemara says, Kari le Yehuda, Yehudi, Alma mimi Yehuda ka'asi. So they call him a Yehudi, must come from Yehuda. The Karila Yemini, they call me Yemini. Alma mimi Binyamin ka'asi, he comes from Binyamin. So the Gemara obviously is not answering the question. The Gemara is asking the question. So which one is it? Is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? So there are a number of different answers to this question. So Rashi number 3 says the following. Rashi on the Megillah writes that Yehudi over here is actually not descriptive of tribal affiliation. Rather, what does Yehudi mean? Al shegola im golos Yehuda. Now we know something very interesting, that when Nebuchadnezzar exiled, when Nebuchadnezzar began the mass waves of exiles, who did he exile first? Correct. He exiled the leaders. He exiled the leaders. That was the word you were looking for. He exiled the leaders. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar was very smart. Nebuchadnezzar realized that if you want to avoid revolt, get rid of leadership. Right? Go ahead, exile leadership first, and the masses, the truth is, are not going to really do anything to in any way rebel or to any way try to shake off your yoke. So he exiles the leaders. So interestingly enough, Yechonyo is the king of Yehuda. The fact that Mordechai was deported, was exiled in the wave, the first wave of exiles, indicates his importance. So therefore, says Rashi, that's what it means when it says that he was from Yehuda. It doesn't literally mean tribal affiliation. Rather, what it means in this particular context was he was important. We see this other places in Tanakh, where Yehudi is used to describe someone who's important. Now, of course, the reason why Yehudi is used to describe someone who is important is because Yehuda was of the most important tribes. Why? Because monarchy comes from Yehuda. Therefore, the way Rashi chooses to go ahead and take care of the problem is by saying Yehudi means he was important, but what tribe was he from? He was from Binyamin. Take a look at number four. The Ibn Ezra points out over here something very interesting. So the Ibn Ezra kind of continues on this same explanation, that really Yehudi is descriptive of his importance. Yemini is really his tribal affiliation. And the Ibn Ezra takes it a step further. The Ibn Ezra posits that it's quite possible that Mordechai was a descendant of Shaul HaMelech, of King Shaul, the first king of the Jewish people. The Ibn Ezra then says the only problem with that is, if indeed he was a descendant of Shaul, it should have what? Should have been mentioned in the Pasuk. Right? Because remember, it does give us, you know, something interesting with genealogies. Genealogies occur one of two ways in Tanakh. Either they just give your father's name, or they go ahead and they give you a genealogy all the way back to someone of incredible importance and note. So this is a strange genealogy, because on one hand it tells us Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, so three generations, which is interesting, but on the other hand, what's intriguing? Nobody who we know. Right? We don't know Yair, Shimi, Kish maybe. Kish perhaps links us to the Shaul family, but there's no one here that grabs our attention. So the Ibn Ezra says, on one hand, he's from Binyamin, which may very well mean that he's a descendant of Shaul. On the other hand, the Megillah does not link him back to Shaul. Okay, that's the Ibn Ezra. Take a look at number five. The Gemara gives an interesting interpretation. The Gemara says, Amar Rabba Baruch Han, Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Aviv mi Binyamin, Imo mi Yehuda. No, it's not a contradiction. His father was from Binyamin, and his mother was from Yehuda. Therefore, the Megillah calls him a Yehudi, and also calls him an Ishimini. What's the problem with this? All right. No offense, ladies, right? But the truth is, whatever tribe you come from doesn't matter all that much in terms of the impact of tribal identity on children, right? Because tribal identity is determined by father. The only time that a mother's tribal affiliation really makes a very big difference is when she is the sole inheritor of property. Then when a woman becomes a sole inheritor of property, then you get into very interesting situations like we had with Benos Tzlafchad, where again, if a woman, technically speaking, intermarries into another tribe, what happens to that particular land? But leaving that aside, the mother's tribal affiliation doesn't really have that much of an impact. So the idea that the Gemara is telling us, that the Megillah is telling us that Mordechai's mother was from Yehuda, and his father was from Binyamin, we'd have to scratch our heads and ask ourselves why the need for this information. Okay, yes?
Well, couldn't it be that he was a descendant of Kish, who was maybe descended from Shaul's brother or something like that? So he wasn't descended, maybe.
It's possible, but then give us the explicit link. Meaning, if you're going to, genealogies work in one of two ways. Either just give us the father, and if you're going to give us more than one generation, link us back to someone who stands out, who we look at the Bible and say, oh, I know who that is. To give us a veiled reference is strange. We don't see that. You're right. Kish may very well be a second cousin twice removed of Shaul. It's possible, but then leave it out if we're not going to know what it is anyway. Yeah? I've got another 45 minutes. Right? Good. We're getting there. Excellent. So now, let's go on a little bit. So here, all I'm doing right now is I'm going to throw at you a lot of information. And then we're going to see what to do with it as we go forward. So, look at number six. The Gemara offers another interpretation. Ish Yehudi Ayabishu Shanabira, Ish Yemini, Maika Amar. So the Gemara says, what is going on over here? If you're coming for a real genealogy, then give us the genealogy all the way back to Binyamin. Now, when the Gemara says all the way back to Binyamin, it doesn't literally mean all the way back to Binyamin. What the Gemara is saying is, give me a genealogy back to someone whom I recognize, who stands out. So the question is, why does the Megillah choose to mention Yair, Shimi, and Kish? So the Gemara gives a very novel interpretation. The Gemara says, Tana, Kulan al Shemo Nikru. The Gemara says this is not a genealogy at all. Rather, all of these names are descriptions of Mordechai. The Gemara says, Ben Yo'ir, what does it mean when it calls him the son of Yo'ir? Ben Sheheir Einayim Shal Yisrael B'Tfilaso. He was the son that illuminated the eyes of the Jewish people with his prayers. Ben Shimi, Ben Sheshama El Tfilaso. The son to whom the father listened to his prayers. Ben Kish Shehikish Al Sha'ari Rachamim B'Niftichu Lo. He was the son who banged, who pounded on the gates of mercy, and they were opened for him. So the Gemara now gives another interpretation, that the truth is, all of these names anyway are not really there for their historical or for linealogical purposes, but rather are here for descriptive purposes. Each of the names identified here in the Megillah are to tell us about another incredible spiritual accomplishment of Mordechai. Number 7, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Li'ola mi-Binyamin ka'asi. No, he comes from Binyamin. Now, this is the approach so far of Rashi, of the Ibn Ezra. He comes from Binyamin. Va'amai kar le-Yehudi. If he comes from Binyamin, so then why is he called the Yehudi? Ashum shekafar ba'avodah zarah. Because he refused to bow to idolatry. And the Gemara goes on to say that whoever stands up for the tenets of Judaism and does not succumb to the pressures of idolatry is called a Yehudi. Is called a Yehudi. Okay, and the Torah Tmima points out, when did Mordechai stand up against idolatry? B'mashlo ishtacha ve'lohaman, shahai satselem shalavodas kochavim chakuka alibo. So the Gemara quotes this idea, because remember, in the Megillah, there's no explicit mention of idolatry. There's explicit mention of Mordechai not bowing down to Haman, but there's no explicit mention of Mordechai not bowing down to idolatry, to which the Torah Tmima suggests that Haman, as the Gemara says, Haman used to wear an idol around his neck, and therefore bowing down to Haman was bowing down to the idol, and therefore Mordechai would not bow down. Okay, number nine. So far, let's go through what we know about Mordechai. What do we know about Mordechai?
He was important.
He was important. Okay, that's a safe answer, right? What tribe was he from? We don't know. It's a machlokes. Maybe he comes from Yehuda. Maybe he comes from Binyamin. Maybe his father is from one tribe. Maybe his mother is from another tribe. Maybe, in fact, Yehudi is not even the name of tribal affiliation, but in fact, Yehudi is a description about his spiritual courage to stand up against idolatry. Maybe even the entire yichus given in the Megillah is not really Mordechai's yichus. Maybe Mordechai's father was not Yo'ir. Maybe his grandfather was not Shimi. Maybe his great-grandfather was not Kish. Perhaps all of those names are descriptive about the spiritual courage and spiritual prowess of Mordechai. Good. Number 9. Vahi omines Hadassah. Let's skip forward a little bit. So what happens? He brought up Hadassah, he Esther Bastodo. She is Esther, his uncle's daughter. Ki in la avaim, for Esther does not have a father and a mother. Vahana'aro yifas toar, betovas mara, she was exceptionally beautiful. Uvimos avia vi'ima, likacha Mordechai lo libas. And when her father and her mother died, Mordechai took her essentially as a surrogate daughter. Number 10, says the Gemara, Vahi omines Hadassah, karile Hadassah, vikarile Esther. Second question, what's her name? What's her name? On one hand, we're calling her Hadassah, and on the other hand, we're calling her Esther. So which is her name? Now remember, here's what's clear. One of the names is her given name, and one of the names is a descriptive name. So the Gemara is trying to understand which is her given name and which is her descriptive name. So the Gemara says, Tanya, the Bryce says, first line number 10, Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer, Esther Shema. Her given name was Esther. Vilama Nikra Shema Hadassah. So why was she called Hadassah? Alshim Hatzadikim Shenikru Hadassim. Because the righteous are often called myrtle branches, are often called Hadassim. We have this idea actually by Sukkis. There's a very strong symbolism there that the Hadassim represented Tzadikim, because the Hadass again has a taste and has a smell. The fragrant scent of the Hadassim often alludes to the righteousness of Tzadikim. So her name is Esther, and Hadassah is just a description of her piety, her personal piety. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Hadassah Shema. Rabbi Yehuda says, no. Her given name is Hadassah. V'lama nikreis shma Esther. So why is she called Esther? Al shem shahaisa misateres devareha. Because she kept all of her words hidden. We'll discuss this a little bit more in just a few moments. That she would not divulge any information about who and what she was. Shine emar in Esther magedes es amok. Because remember, the shorish of Esther is Seser. Seser, Samich Tov Reish, which means hidden, which means secret. So ultimately, again, her name is Hadassah, but Esther is a descriptive name because she was very secretive. Everything about her was a big secret. Next, Rabbi Nechemya Omer, correct, I agree with you, Hadassah Shema. Her given name is Hadassah. So why is she called Esther? Lamini Grace Esther. Shaya Umo Sa'olam Korin Osa Ashum Istahar. So it's a very beautiful idea. Esther was the name that was actually given to her by her subjects. Right? Why? Istahar in Aramaic means the moon. The moon always represents beauty. So her subjects called her Esther because her beauty was as magnificent as the moon. Ben Azai says, Esther, Ben Azai wants to suggest that Esther was her name. If her name was Esther, then why was she called Hadassah? This is actually very interesting. The Gemara says, Lo Arucha Velo Kitzar Haisa. Esther was not very tall. Esther was not very short. Ella Beinonis. She was average, whatever average means. Kihadasa. I guess in the plant world. So the myrtle branch is not too tall, it's not too short, it's perfect. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karacha says Esther was her name. So why was she called Hadassah? Yirokrokes haisa. Yirokrokes means literally she had an olive complexion, a Mediterranean complexion. V'chut shel chesed mashuch aleha. And it was incredible divine, there was incredible divine favor that literally was over her, that made her appear even more beautiful in the eyes of many. So it's actually interesting, not a topic for today, but there's an interesting dispute among the commentaries about how does Rabbi Yoshua mean this idea that she was of olive complexion? Does Rabbi Yoshua mean that as a display of beauty? Or does Rabbi Yoshua mean that as a lack of beauty, and the only reason people found her beautiful was because of this chut shel chesed, this incredible divine favor that was around her? Simple pshat is that her olive complexion was her Mediterranean beauty. It was her Mediterranean, and her beauty was amplified by the fact that she also had a chut shel chesed on her. So again, now the Gemara, what's Esther's name? Let's, right? We're not sure Machlokes, right? Is it Esther? Here's what we know. They're both her name. The only fundamental question is which one is her given name, which one is her descriptive name. Number 11. Uvamos avia v'ima lekachala Mordechai lebas. So the Gemara says that when her parents died, Mordechai took her as a daughter. Tanamishun Rabbi Meir. Al tikri lebas ela lebayis. So Rabbi Meir says, no. Don't read it as lebas. Rather, don't read it as a daughter. Rather, read it how? Lebayis. Lebayis as a home. What does that mean? Look at number 12. So the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yossi, miyomai lo karisi liishti ishti, ela liishti beisi. Rabbi Yossi says so beautifully, I never called my wife, rather I always called my wife my home. Representing this idea of the woman as the Akeres Habayis, wherever the wife is, that's where the home is. Therefore the Gemara says over here, don't say that he took her as a bas, rather he took her as a bias, he took her as a wife. Okay, so now the Gemara tells us, even the nature of the relationship between Mordechai and Esther is subject to incredible dispute. Was this a more paternal relationship, like a father to a daughter, or was this a romantic relationship as a husband to a wife? Number 13. Lo higida Esther es amo ve'es moladeta, ki Mordechai tzivo ala asher lo sagid. So what happens? Esther is taken for Achashverosh's pageant, and Esther does not reveal her nation and her people, her nation and her nation and her birthplace. Why? Because Mordechai told her not to reveal it. So interestingly enough, Esther doesn't really make her own decision in this area. She follows Mordechai's counsel. Every single day, Mordechai walks by the courtyard of the woman's home. Beis Hanashim is the harem. So he walks by the courtyard of the harem every day. Ladas es shlom Esther, to see how Esther's doing. Umaya aseba, and what's happening? So there's a fascinating discussion. Why does Mordechai tell Esther not to divulge or reveal her identity and where she's from? So Rashi quotes in number 14 the following idea. Rashi says, Asher lo sagid, kidei sheyomru shimi mishpacha bezuya v'yishalchuha. What's going to happen? If she doesn't, generally, if a person's not willing to divulge the details of their familial history, to divulge their yichus, chances are what? It's not good, right? Chances are they're hiding something. So good. That's what Mordechai is banking on. That they're going to assume if Esther is not revealing her familial lineage, if she's not revealing anything about where she's born or where she's from, chances are Mishpacha Bezuya, she's from compromised lineage, and the king would never ever select her to be queen. After all, again, we're assuming that a king would be looking for some degree of yichus. About, however, Rashi says something very interesting. Shimyeidu shim Mishpachas Shaul HaMelech Hayu Machazikim. So here Rashi says something quite fascinating, which some agree with, some disagree with, that Esther was a descendant of King Shaul. Esther was a descendant of Shaul, which one thing we know, which is if you go with the approach that Ishimini Mordechai is from Binyamin, and that Kish is related to Shaul, we know that Mordechai and Esther are related. That we know for sure, right? Because again, the text explicitly says that she is the daughter of his uncle. So it could be that Esther is the one who's more directly related to Shaul. So Rashi goes with the approach that if it were to become divulged, if it were to be divulged that Esther is descendant of royalty, then Ahasuerus would chop her up immediately, because again, who wouldn't want a wife of royal lineage? Number 15, the Al-Sheikh says, same basic idea. He says, if you look at the last two lines, Shimlo Kain, Ki haysa magedes es amo ve'es moladeto, yichabduha a'im oz ba'asher ha-shemita. Again, so Al-Sheikh echoes the same basic idea as Rashi. If she divulges who she is, where she's from, potentially descendant of Jewish monarchy, they will immediately select her as king. 16, the Reed is Rabbeinu David, with commentary on the Megillah, says something amazing. He says, same basic idea, Mipnei she'Esther nolda miyichus godol, v'hayis ha'guna l'malchus. Esther is descendant of royalty, and therefore she was befitting of marrying into royalty. Mipnei zeh tziva l'Mordechai shelo togid, kedei shelo tinase lo v'titama ben agoyim. And Mordechai is concerned that if it's found out that she is royalty, the king will want to marry her, and she'll be defiled among the nations. Fine. Comes along the Ebenezer.
Doesn't Nebuchadnezzar come in here? Isn't he some kind of...
Nebuchadnezzar is long dead. He's king three kings ago. He's mentioned in the beginning of the Megillah as the one who exiled the first wave of leaders, but he's dead. Vashti was his granddaughter. Take a look at number 17, the Ibn Ezra. So the Ibn Ezra writes something amazing. Now, hold on to your seats for this one, because this is going to forever change your conception of the Megillah and of Mordechai, which is what it's supposed to do. Yesh Omrim. There are those who say, Ki Mordechai lo asa nechona. Mordechai made a terrible mistake. Shetziva al Esther shelo togid ama. What's Mordechai's mistake? That Mordechai told her not to divulge her identity. Says the Ibn Ezra, why did Mordechai tell her not to divulge her identity? Ki pachad shelo yikachena hamelech liisha im yeda shehi me'agola. According to this first approach of the Ibn Ezra, Mordechai wants her to be selected as queen. Mordechai wants her to become the wife of the king. And if Esther were to divulge the fact that she is a Jewess, then what would happen? That would diminish her chances for being crowned, because no one wants to crown a refugee as queen. Therefore, according, now again, this is not the Ebenezer's own pshat, he's quoting someone else, but according to this approach, again, Mordechai's entire calculated strategy is getting Esther elected to the monarchy, getting her chosen as the queen. Therefore, says Esther, keep your mouth closed. Mordechai tells her, keep your mouth closed, don't say anything, because if you tell them you're a Jew, they're going to immediately expel you from the pageant. Okay. V'achirim omrim, again, a radically different interpretation. V'achirim omrim, ki b'derech nevua o b'cholom yada, shetavo teshua al yada li Yisrael. So of course the question then becomes, why would Mordechai do that? Right? Why does Mordechai want Esther to become queen? Why would he do it to himself, especially if they're married? And why would he do it to her, even if they're not married? So some want to posit that Mordechai, this is always, you know, I'm always a little suspicious when you see this answer. Because, you know, whenever you're in a tough spot, it's always easy to say, oh, it was Nevuah. Right? So what does that mean? First of all, we're going to see there's no Nevuah in this time anymore. So to say that Mordechai knew Nevuah, now I want to just say, Nevuah doesn't have to mean prophecy. prophecy. Sometimes nevuah also means intuition. That it could very well be that according to this approach, Mordechai realizes the writing is on the wall. It's only a matter of time until a despot like Ahasuerus turns against the Jewish people. To have a sleeper queen, right? To have a sleeper Jew in the palace. Someone who, again, could assume the mantle of queen, and if there's ever danger, we could activate her and she could act on our behalf, is a very powerful thing. So according to this first portion of Ibn Ezra, everything Mordechai does, again, this is totally contrary to any way we normally learn the story, because normally we learn the story of Esther is resistant, Mordechai is resistant, says the Ibn Ezra, maybe not. Maybe Mordechai is actually complicit. Maybe Mordechai actually wants this to happen, and actually tries to coach Esther as to how to position herself to increase the probability that she will be selected as queen. Don't say anything, don't divulge any information. Why? Whether he has nevuah, whether he has intuition, or perhaps, again, we'll see, those who fault Mordechai for this actually feel that he has some other ulterior motives, which we'll get to later on. However, the Ibn Ezra says something amazing. But yes, question?
If she was his wife, didn't he have the fear that she would be chosen? Didn't he have the fear that the king would be that she wasn't Sula?
Yeah, good. So we'll get, first of all, we'll see that Ahasuerus was not very makbid on the Vesulas. Right? Ahasuerus wasn't worried about if the woman was married, if the woman was single, if she was a Vesula, wasn't a Vesula. We're not talking about a person of exceptionally high moral caliber who was worried about, I thought you were, virginally pure. Oh, you're not, so the shidduch is off. No, he's not so worried about that. Correct. I'm sorry. That was the first time around. The second time around, apparently, the Basula pool wasn't large enough for Ahasuerosh. So the Gemara actually says that he even took married women. Even married women volunteered to be. You're talking about, remember, a very morally bankrupt society. Right? And the table is set for that already at the beginning. Right? With the whole party that happened, the whole demise of Vashti. You know, when a Vashti-like figure becomes the voice of morality in a kingdom, you know you're in very big trouble. In very big trouble. That being said, we will come back to this point. Yes? I'm not here to answer for it, right? Okay. On the other hand, if you understand that Bederech Nevuah, he feels that something's going to happen, so sometimes drastic actions have to be taken in drastic situations. Yes, please.
But she herself, she didn't have a big makeup or anything, to make herself more attractive.
Right. So again, remember, all we're commenting over here is Mordechai. Right? We have not discussed Esther's desire. Clearly from the text, Esther does not have a desire for this. But at the end of the day, she takes Mordechai's advice and she does not divulge the information. Correct. The text makes it clear that she does not do anything to endear herself to the king or to increase her chances of being chosen. That being said, she still acts on the advice of Mordechai, whoever he is to her, and does not divulge her identity. Yes? She didn't. She didn't. Yeah, how did she make it through all the levels? The truth is, there is an answer to that. I mean, the simple answer always is, was a Kadosh Baruch Hu, right? That's always, whenever in doubt, we always look upward. But there's a simpler answer. The Malbim says that, which is a totally different shir, but the Malbim brings down that Ahasuerus was looking to establish, essentially, an autocratic monarchy. Right, there are different types of monarchies. There's constitutional monarchies, in which case a king is bound by the laws of the land, and a king has to follow the wills of the subject. And there's more of an autocratic monarchy, where the king essentially makes the rules. Ahasuerus is looking to go ahead and establish an autocratic monarchy. That's why, interestingly enough, we know historically, the capital of the Persian Median Empire was never in Shushan. It's Ahasuerus who moves it to Shushan. So some, including the Malbim, posit that for Ahasuerus, the best kind of queen was an anonymous queen. because the whole reason why he got into this whole power struggle with Vashti is because she felt she had a monarchical identity on her own. Don't talk to me. I have royal blood. So some want to suggest that for Ahasuerus, actually the most enticing shidduch was one where there was no royal blood. So the only reason your queen, remember, you'll look in the text, when Ahasuerus summons Vashti, he summons her as Vashti Hamalka. When she responds to him, she always responds to him as Hamalka Vashti. And so the commentaries point out the struggle over here is he tries to tell her, you're queen because I made you queen. She says, honey, I'm queen because I come from queens. Right? You are, whoever Ahasuerus was, the stable boy, the general, either way, there's one thing clear, he's not royalty. So the Malbim says that what happened over here is, to a certain degree, Esther walked right into this desire, because here, Esther is a no one, or she puts herself forward as a no one, she's beautiful, and so for Ahasuerus, she's got alamailus, right? There's she's beautiful, okay, and there's nothing to her. There's no family, there's no identity, there's no monarchy. This is perfect. So there is a chachma to the fact that she was able to progress despite not sharing any information about who she was. Take a look at number 17. Still, let's finish this up. So the Ebenezer makes another suggestion. The Ebenezer writes, skip down in paragraph A, halfway down, five lines up from the bottom. Bahanochon ve'enai. So the Ebenezer writes, but it would appear to me, what's appropriate in my eyes, ki asa zeh Mordechai ba'avur shetishmar Torah Hashem b'seiser. Why did Mordechai tell her not to divulge her identity? In order that she should be able to keep the tenets of the Torah while she was in the palace. Remember, no one knew what was going to happen to these women. Because remember, although only one woman was going to go ahead and be selected as queen, what was going to happen to all those who weren't selected? Were they going to remain in the harem? Were they going to be sent back home? So there was absolutely no idea how long was this going to go on for. So Mordechai says to Esther, according to Ibn Ezra, you know, we have to plan long term. And so if you're going to be in the palace for a long time, because we don't know how long you're going to be there, how do we create a situation where we'll be able to keep the tenets of the Torah? Because there's one thing that's for sure, which is that Shushan, the palace of the king, is not exactly Jewish friendly or Jewish accommodating. There doesn't seem to be any kind of blatant or overt anti-Semitism, at least not yet. But again, Mordechai already feels that you're not going to be able to keep up your Jewish practices. So how can you do it? By keeping your identity quiet. Shelo tochal nevelos, v'tishmar ha-shabasos, v'liyagisha ha-mesharas. You know what Ibn Ezra is saying? Something amazing. You know, if you tell people that you keep kosher, so the truth is, you keep kosher, it's archaic, it's outdated. But if you tell people that you don't like to ingest certain type of predatory animals because you feel that it disrupts your yin and your yang, you know, you feel that it disrupts your internal equilibrium because you like to keep the harmony in nature, then, oh, wow, what a person, right? You tell somebody that you keep Shabbos, that's ridiculous. You tell someone that I need a day to connect with myself. I like to meditate, I like to cogitate, I like to whatever I like to tate, you know, whatever it is, then suddenly, wow, you are such a spiritually wonderful person. So Mordechai says to Esther, listen, if you go in there telling them that you're Jewish, and suddenly whatever, you need Shabbos, and you need kosher, and you need this, they're going to tell you no. But if you just go in there, don't say anything, and do your own thing, no one's really going to ask you any questions. So you want to be a vegetarian? It's exceptionally wonderful and humane and beautiful. All the power to you. And no one is ever going to, chas v'shalom, ever go ahead and try to share your vegetarian kite. Right? But kosher, Shabbos, that's when you're going to get into problems. So here the Ebenezer suggests, just keep your Jewish identity under wraps, and you will see that it is much easier for you to adhere and to keep to the tenets of your Judaism. Okay, so let's go on a little bit. So go to number 18. Go to number 18. Now remember, we're still trying to figure out why exactly it is that Mordechai is telling Esther not to divulge her identity. So far we've seen, either again, is Mordechai right for doing it, not right for doing it, for his own purposes, for Esther's purposes, is it in order to increase her chances for getting chosen, decrease her chances for getting chosen? Look at number 18. With this, we'll stop, we'll bring everything together. Rabbi Avigdor Cohen Tzedek, a 16th century commentary on the Megillah, writes something absolutely amazing. He asks a different kasha. He says, why is Mordechai coming to the Shar HaMelech? To the two things that's happening, the Megillah says. One, in the pasuk we quoted before, he's coming to the Chatzar Beis HaNashim. He's coming to the courtyard of the harem every day. Why? What are you going to do? Right? Mordechai, remember, Mordechai is an important individual, but doesn't have the power to actually do anything right now. So you're coming to check up on Esther every day. What exactly is it that you're trying to accomplish? Furthermore, the Megillah says in the next pasuk, adding quote on the sheet, is that every single day, he's bechatzar beis hamelech. He's at the courtyard. He's at the entranceway of the palace. Why is Mordechai coming every single day? So Rabbi Avigdor Kohen Tzedek says something absolutely amazing. He says, look at the left-hand paragraph. Second line in, last word on the line. V'yishlomar, Yoshav Mordechai umetzape. This is also going to blow your mind. Masai shahaya yachal lignov es Esther loholicha lemalchus acheres. What is Mordechai doing? Mordechai is waiting for the moment that he could abduct Esther and they could run away together. Run away to another land outside of the reach of Ahasuerus. Now again, this especially, the truth is this fits whether or not they have a paternal daughter relationship or whether or not they have a marital relationship. Mordechai is coming every single day to see, is there a window that I can get her out of this? And Rav Avigdor Kohen Tzedek says something absolutely amazing. Again, I don't know how much proof there is for this approach in the text, but it's fascinating nevertheless. He says over here, ki haise ishto, because she was his wife. Something amazing. So Rav Avigdor Kohen Tzedek says something fascinating. He says to Esther, don't divulge where you're from. Why? Because what's Mordechai's plan? Right now Esther has been taken to the palace, taken to the harem. Mordechai comes every single day because he holds out the hope that there'll be a moment he'll be able to extract his wife from this, and they'll have to run away. They'll forever have to leave their life in Shushan. They'll forever have to leave even the Persian Median Empire. Wherever they're going to go, it's going to have to be far out of the reach of Ahasuerus. So every single day he comes looking for his moment. Why does he tell him not to divulge her identity? Because if he's successful and they're able to run away together, and Ahasuerus knows that she is Jewish, who is going to be held accountable, right, for the disappearance of the queen? The Jewish people. But if no one knows who Esther is, right, Rav Avigdor Kohen Tzedek, then if Mordechai is successful in abducting her and running away together, the king isn't going to be able to hold anyone accountable for what has happened. Okay, so we just did a lot in the first 18 sources. So let's analyze what we know. So who is what tribe is Mordechai from? Okay, we don't know, right? Maybe Binyamin, maybe Yehuda, maybe mother from one, maybe mother from the other. Maybe one is the tribe, maybe one is a descriptive. Maybe the genealogy isn't a genealogy. Maybe it's an entire spiritual description of Mordechai. Fine. What's Esther's name? Right? We're not sure. We know that it's Hadassah and Esther, but we don't know which is her given name, which is her descriptive name. Was a descriptive name given to her by her subjects? Was a descriptive name given to her by the Megillah? Was a descriptive name given to her by the Jewish people? Not sure. What's the relationship between Mordechai and Esther? Don't know. Is it a bas? Is it a bias? Right? Is it a paternal relationship? Is it a marital relationship? Why does Mordechai tell Esther not to divulge her information? We don't know, right? Is it because he wants her to be queen, doesn't want her to be queen? Is he doing something good, doing something not good? Is it a desire to get her elected, a desire to try to abduct her? And I say abduct sounds bad, meaning to rescue her and to get her. We don't know. So if there's one thing that we know from the first 18 sources, it's what? That we don't have any idea what is really happening in the Megillah. Right? And isn't this fascinating? So the story that we think we know, the story that we think that is so simple and so clear, we know the characters, the reality is shrouded in incredible ambiguity. We don't even the name, by the way, we'll talk about this more next week because we'll spend one more share in the Megillah, even the name Mordechai is subject to some dispute. Right? The Gemara wants to suggest that Mordechai is actually a contraction of two words, Mar Doror, which refers to the two of the spices in the Ketores. Others posit that in fact Mordechai was more of an idolatrous name, a Hebraicized Marduk, which we'll get to next week a little bit more. Even the very identity, so we don't know really who Mordechai is in his essence. We can't even get a straight name for who Esther is in her essence. We don't know, again, this pivotal piece of advice that ultimately sets the stage for Esther's selection as queen. We don't know why it was given. We don't know the intention of why it was given. We don't actually know, was it a good thing it was was given, not a good thing that it was given. We don't even know if the two major characters in the story, what their relationship are to each other. And by the way, lest you think that is just a detail, that's not a detail at all. Whether or not they were husband and wife, or more of a father-daughter relationship, colors the story in two dramatically different ways. All of these are important details, and yet, we don't know. So you have to appreciate something. Whenever you see such a level of ambiguity within Tanakh, you have to automatically understand what? That it's by design. There is no such thing as incidental Torah ambiguity. Because when the Torah wants to be specific, the Torah is exceptionally specific. When the Torah wants to be ambiguous, it's ambiguous by design. So which means that if we have this Megillah called Megillas Esther, that is ambiguous and such profound levels of ambiguity. And by the way, I only quoted to you from the first couple of psukim right in the beginning of the Megillah. If we had more time, we can show this ambiguity goes all the way through. In every single major event of the Megillah, there is this incredible ambiguity as to what exactly is happening here, which then leads us to the fundamental question of why. If the ambiguity is by design, why? So take a look at number 19. Rav Soloveitchik says something absolutely amazing. So the Rav has a series of essays that are under the title of Days of Deliverance, which are essays on Hanukkah and Purim. So here the Rav says something, and even the way he writes it is so beautiful. The Rav says, the Megillah contains the story of events that occurred in the twilight hour of Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day full of song, color, and joy. A day on which God's word was on many tongues and His spirit in many hearts. It ushers in a dark, dreary autumnal night of silence and fear. A night in the course of which God stopped speaking to His people. At that time, the covenantal community was losing slowly but surely the most precious of all gifts, prophecy. The great covenantal dialogue between man and God that had commenced with Abraham was about to be terminated. And the prophetic community faced a stark, ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence. With the transition from a prophetic to a non-prophetic community, the Jewish historical experience changed completely. So the Rav here says something absolutely amazing. Before we even go on, you know what's amazing about Megillas Esther? Megillas Esther is the first book of Tanakh written in the post-prophetic age. There's something that happens in Megillas Esther that does not happen anywhere else, which is there's no Vayedaber Hashem Amo Shalemar. There's no God spoke to the prophet saying. Forget about God not speaking in the Megillah. What's missing from the Megillah? Any mention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Says the Rav, that's by design. Why? Because Megillas Esther is the first book of the post-prophetic era. Prophecy is coming to a close. Paragraph B. The mission with which Moshe was charged was precisely defined. There was no alternative but to act in a strictly prescribed manner. Moshe did not enjoy freedom of decision and action. He received specific instructions, what to do and how to accomplish it. Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward. Lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea. So this is amazing. I want to spend a moment on this. Moshe Rabbeinu does not act on his own volition. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he is chosen by God to lead the Jewish people, is also given what? He's given the playbook. Given the playbook, here's what you have to do, here's what you have to do, here's how you have to do it, and here's when you have to do it. Moshe Rabbeinu has to exercise no imagination and no innovation. Moshe Rabbeinu has to follow the rules. Interestingly enough, and what happens when Moshe Rabbeinu does not follow the rules? Right? The one time that Moshe Rabbeinu goes off script and hits the rock instead of speaking, there are disastrous results. Again, this is not to diminish the role of Moshe Rabbeinu, because as we know, it's exceptionally difficult to follow instructions. It's exceptionally difficult to follow the rules. It's one of the hardest things in life is to be a good soldier. But that was Moshe Rabbeinu's mandate. God gives him the instructions. God tells him what to do, how to do it, when to do it. In fact, interestingly enough, that's why by Yam Suf, the Rav makes reference to this episode, when Moshe Rabbeinu calls out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu what to do, what does God say to him? Matitzak Elai. Why are you davening? Dabra Abinis, I told you what to do. I told you what to do. Stop. You don't need to do this. You don't need to daven. You don't need to engage me. You don't need to. I already gave you the instructions. Now, the instructions were difficult. The instructions were walk into the sea. So even when you have instructions, following them is not simple, but they are instructions nevertheless. Moshe Rabbeinu lives in the age of scripted divine engagement. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you what he wants you to do and how he wants you to do it in explicit terms. On the other hand, says the Rav Mordechai, in contrast to this kind of agency, received not a clearly defined, but a multifaceted mandate. It was left to him how to interpret and implement this mandate. Mordechai was confronted with a number of alternatives. The choice was his. He exercised free judgment. In Egypt, God acted, man was an onlooker. In Persia, God summoned man to act freely and wisely under God's supervision and watchful eyes. So this is quite amazing. So says the Rav something dramatically fantastic, which is the Megillah is ambiguous by design. Why? Because what does the ambiguity highlight? That we have left the age of divine clarity. We have left the age where God communicates his explicit word, his explicit will, his explicit desire, his explicit instructions through the prophet, and the prophet conveys it to us. That era, that age, has come to an end. And what has it ushered in? It's ushered in the world of ambiguity. Remember, there are very few things, like, for honest with ourselves, there are very few things in life that are black and that are white. The truth is, those who try to take an easy path in life like to make everything black and white. But those who are truly intellectually and spiritually honest understand that very little of the world is black and white. The overwhelming majority of the world is gray. The overwhelming majority of the world is ambiguous. We're not sure, is it good, is it bad? Is it tov, is it ra? Is it tameh, is it tahor? And that becomes our mandate in this world. Our mandate in this world is to engage the gray and try to figure out what is it. Is it? And you know what's amazing? In the world of gray, you often have to make a lot of decisions. And what's the challenge? You don't know if your decisions were right or were wrong sometimes until many years later. So Mordechai tells Esther not to divulge her identity. Was it the right decision or the wrong decision? Right or wrong? Things worked out well is a very relative statement. Things worked out well for me and you, right? Right. So did Mordechai make the right decision? The answer is, Mordechai made the right decision based on his current understanding of the circumstances. Could he have made a different decision that would have yielded better results? It's possible. We'll see this later on. Mordechai chooses not to bow down. Was that the right decision? To Haman, was that the right decision or the wrong decision? We don't know. Many disagreed with his decision. Many of his rabbinic peers disagreed. Many of the other leading rabbanim all bowed down to Haman, but Mordechai did not. Was it right or was it wrong? The answer is, we don't know. It's easy for us to be like, of course he was right. He didn't bow down to Haman. Shkoyach, right? 3,000 years later, we're all safe and secure. Of course, you shouldn't bow down to Haman. Right? So everybody else bowed down except Mordechai. What does that say? To me, that speaks volumes. That maybe Mordechai was wrong. Maybe he should have bowed down like everyone else, and he would have avoided irking Haman. Maybe that was... But the answer is, in the world of gray, you don't have God telling you what to do. In the world of ambiguity, you don't have explicit instructions from the Ribono Sholem. And in the world of ambiguity, in the world of Megillas Esther, you have to make decisions to the best of your ability. Sometimes they're right. Sometimes they're profoundly wrong. Sometimes you have to backtrack. Sometimes you have to start over. But that's the nature of existence in the Megillas Esther world. I didn't put this on the sheet, but you know, the Rambam writes that in La'asid Lavo, when Mashiach comes, many of the Sfarim of Tanakh we have will no longer be included in Tanakh. Because many of them speak about suffering. Many of them speak about what's going to happen in the Messianic era. When the Messianic era, one Megillah, the Gemara says, the Rambam says, that is going to remain La'olam Void, is Megillas Esther. Why? Because Megillas Esther is the story of the human condition. Because Megillas Esther is the story of ambiguity. And the truth is, most of us live lives of ambiguity. Most of us live lives where we have to make a lot of difficult decisions in difficult circumstances. And the truth is, there's that little voice in the back of our head that always wonders, did we choose wisely? And sometimes much later on, we realize the decisions we thought were wrong were right. and realize many of the decisions we thought were right were in fact wrong, but they're not really wrong because they were the best decisions we could have made in the circumstances we were in at that time. And this is, so says the Rav, Megillas Esther is not ambiguous by accident. It's not ambiguous because someone forgot to read through the draft, you know, and clarify the information a little bit more. It's ambiguous by design because the ambiguity helps us understand the context in which this story is unfolding. Megillas Esther is beginning in the world, the post-prophetic world. There are no explicit instructions. There is no Nabi to guide us. There is no Devar Hashem coming and booming out from the heavens. Man has to figure out how to live his life and assume responsibility for the decisions that he makes. Assume responsibility for the right decision and assume responsibility for the wrong decisions. Yes?
So, but we don't really say, like, why she wouldn't have fled the country. The Bible says she's taking all the Jewish women. And she wouldn't want to leave.
Right. So the simple answer is, remember, because I think also the Megillah begins in a very important way, that Ahasuerus ruled over 127 countries. Ahasuerus ruled over much of the civilized world. Where are you going to go? Right. So that's the problem with what Rav Yitzchak Cohen said, like, where did Mordechai think he was going to go? But you know what? Sometimes when a loved one is in distress, you don't always think rationally. Right? Sometimes what you do is you act and you figure it out later. If you go, Avigdor Cohen said, it goes with the idea that Esther was Mordechai's wife. In which case, then maybe Mordechai did not figure out where they were going to go. But all he knew is that he had to find a way to get his wife out of this situation. Where? We'll figure out. But that could also explain why she didn't run. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? He occupies most of the civilized world. And if you run and he catches you, you run the risk of being dealt with even more harshly. So that's a different discussion about the halachic ramifications of what Esther did. So that's a separate shir. Well, actually, we'll touch on that. I hope to do one more shir on Megillas Esther next week. We'll focus a little bit more on Mordechai, but we'll touch on that as well. But there's a lot of... Esther had halachic ground to stand on, which is why, by the way, that the entire story, the simple answer is that Esther was violated against her will. That's the simple answer, that she was taken by Ahasuerus against her will. And if a woman is violated against her will, she's not obligated to give up her life rather than be violated. Which is why, when she initiates contact with Ahasuerus, when she seeks him out, she says those words that we actually read in the tune of Echa, Kasher Avadati, Avadati. Which, if you go with the idea that she is Mordechai's wife, what she's really saying to Mordechai is, I'll go, but just understand that this closes the door forever to us. Because once I go and I make this dramatic step, I initiate contact with him. In which case, I cannot claim that I'm being violated. If that's the case, then a woman becomes usher to her husband. She becomes forbidden to her husband. So, there is that shift in the story.
Is that why we say, usher in Mishnah 2? Oh, the Yanakahu. The whole Megillas Esther is all not mixed up, but you know what I mean.
No, it's ambiguous, 100%, 100%. And that's why everything that begins one way turns a different way. So I'll just show you, just in the 2 minutes that we have left, I just want to show you something interesting, that I think this also helps to understand many of the practices of Purim. So to go with this idea that the Megillah is ambiguous by design, Megillah is ambiguous by design, and it's ambiguous by design because the Megillah ambiguity sheds light on worldly ambiguity that we experience. It's the world of ambiguity, the world of gray that we live in after the close of the prophetic era, after the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, and it's in that world. What's our job in that world? What's our job in the world of ambiguity? What's our job in the world of gray? To try to do the best you can. To try to live a Tahar life, a Kadosh life, a good life. You know, like the Ramchal says, like Ramosh Chaim Lesato brings down in his introduction, in the first chapter of Misgas Sharm, he says that we live life by one simple question. Ma chovaso ba'olamo? What am I supposed to do in this world? And the reason why that is just such a challenging question is because we live in a world of ambiguity. Because we don't actually know what it is that we're supposed to accomplish in this world. We're not actually 100% sure what it is that I'm supposed to be doing. And there's always that little voice in the back of my head that even when we think we're doing something good, I have to wonder to myself, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? Or is there something else I'm supposed to be engaged in? That's our job in the world of ambiguous gray. To try to figure out how to become the best people we can, how to serve the Ribon Shalom, how to serve our people. But it's difficult because often we don't know if we're doing it right. So look at number 20. So the Shulchan Aruch here says something fascinating. The Shulchan Aruch writes, We wear costumes. Pirtzufim literally is masks on Purim. Now it gets even better. V'gever lovesh simlas isha, v'isha kli gever. And a man could wear women's clothing, and a woman could wear men's clothing. Ain isser bedaver. So it's not aser. So what's intriguing about this is, that's funny, because every other day of the year is aser, right? Again, the Torah is explicit biblical prohibition, right? Lo silbash kever simlas yisha, right? A man is not permitted to wear women's clothing. Women can't wear men's clothing for fear of immorality. So yet, you have something that is biblically prohibited every other day of the year. But on Purim, it's okay. Why? Shein mechav ne'el l'simcha ba'amba. Because God forbid, there's no immoral intentions. It's only for simcha. And he goes on and he explains another idea. For example, v'chein b'nei adam, ha'chotfim zemi zederech simcha. On Purim, apparently, people used to grab stuff from each other. So I'm not sure. I guess it means, I see you have really good shalach manas, right? That hamantash looks very good. So what happens? I go over, I grab your hamantash. So during the rest of the year, we would call that an act of gezel. We call that an act of theft. On Purim, it's okay. On Purim, people take stuff from each other, and it's all right. No one's really that makpid. No one really stands us. It's all right. You can take it. You can have it. Okay. Then if you look at them, we actually discussed this extensively on Sunday. You have the concept in 22. A person gets intoxicated on Purim until I don't know they're seeing Arhaman and Baruch Mordechai. So we're not going to go through this again because we spent an hour on this on Sunday. But if you take a look on 24, the Shulchan Aruch says, remember the statement of the Rama, Echad Hamarbe Ve'echad Hamamit Ubilvachi Echavi Libo L'Shamayim. Remember the Rama says, whether you drink a lot, whether you drink a little, whatever you do, just make sure you're serving on Kadosh Baruch Hu. So here's something, so you understand why Purim is such a bizarre day. So look what's happening over here. We are doing things that the rest of the year are at worst, literally usher, or at best, really frowned upon. So we're wearing the other gender's clothing, which, are, again, that's not an obligation, obviously, but what it's saying is that you're permitted to do so. So during the 364 days of the year, that's an Isser D'Oraisa, biblical prohibition. Purim is okay because it's just Simcha, right? 364 days of the year, if I steal your hamantash, I'm a thief. Right? One day out of the year, if I do it, it's okay because we're friends. Right? Simcha. Right? 364 days of the year, we caution excessively against drunkenness. Because again, drunkenness, as we spoke about on Sunday, only every single recorded episode we have of drunkenness always leads to some kind of bad result. And Yeram Purim, not only is it okay, but it's actually a mitzvah. So let me complicate this one little bit more. Look at 25. So the Mishnah Berurah says, in the midst of this whole discussion about cross-dressing, stealing hamantashin, and getting drunk. So the Mishnah Berurah says, "V'ayin bo'or zarua, d'miko makom, yire lihios zohir b'inyan netilas yadayim, birchas hamotzi, u'birchas hamosom." So the Mishnah says, but you should be very careful to wash. And you should be very careful to make an Altias Adayim and a hamotzi, and make sure to bench. Not only that, but he goes on, he quotes the Prima Gadim, who says, last line 25, the inyan sudas pur matal zavyonim umushloach manos efshad the tzarech kavana azal shem mitzvah. Quickly, normally we assume that mitzvahs eno shrichos kavana. When you do a mitzvah, you don't have to have explicit intent as to why you're doing it. So if I light Shabbos candles, so I don't really have to know why I'm lighting Shabbos candles. I don't have to appreciate the reason for it. All I have to know is that it's a mitzvah. That's enough. And I'm yotzi the mitzvah. And that's usually, if I put on tefillin, I don't have to know why I'm putting on tefillin. It's I'm doing it because Kadosh Baruch Hu asked me to do it. So some want to suggest that when I come to the mitzvahs of Purim, you're only yotzi, you only discharge your obligation if you have explicit kavana to do it for the sake of mitzvah. So meaning, if you sit down to your meal on Purim and you don't have explicit kavana, explicit intent that I'm doing this for the sake of Sudas Purim, it's not called the Purim Sudas, it's just called dinner. Or if I give Mishloach Manos and I don't have kavana that this is for the sake of fulfilling mitzvah Mishloach Manos, I'm not yotzi, it's just a nice gift of food. Or I give Matanos Levyonim and it's not for the explicit dinner Matanos Levyonim, it's just tzedakah. Strange. So you see what's happening over here? On one hand, we have a license to do all of these behaviors that, again, the rest of the year are mamish, asur, or at least significantly frowned upon. But yet, the Mishnah Berurah says, but be very careful with the details of halacha. Make sure that you go ahead and wash, make sure you bench, make sure you daven, make sure you do all your mitzvahs with kavana. So what's the pshat? Because this is the very essence of Purim, and this is the very essence of the human condition. That what's happening over here, we're doing things on Purim that look strange, right? That's the point of it. We're doing things on Purim that seem to convey ambiguous messages. We're doing things on Purim that seem to paint a different picture than the way we live our lives the rest of the year. And what's our job on that day when we seem to be painting conflicting pictures? What's our job? Our job is to still make sure that we are careful with the details of Avodas Hashem. That I might be wearing women's clothing and I might be stealing Hamantashen, because the truth is that's representative of the gray world of ambiguity in which we live in. We're never sure exactly what anything really is, what anything really looks like. But even when you are shrouded, even when you are enveloped by the gray ambiguity of the world, make sure you wash, make sure you say Hamotzi, make sure you bench, make sure you do mitzvahs with kavono. Because that's the job of the Jew. We live in the post-prophetic world. We live in the ambiguous gray world of Megillas Esther. We live in a world that often it's difficult to discern what's kadosh, what's not, what's tameh, what's tahar, what's mutter, what's aser. We live in a world where sometimes we don't even know really who we are. Right? I don't know if I'm an Esther. I don't know if I'm a Hadassah. I don't know if I'm from Binyamin. I don't know if I'm from Yehuda. We live in a world, we live lives that so often we even doubt our own identity. Because it's a difficult world we live in. And it's a difficult period of time we live in. Baruch Hashem, as much as it's so much better than so many generations before us, in the post-prophetic world comes with its challenges of gray ambiguity. But what's our job? Our job is within all of the ambiguity to try to seek out the Kiddushah, to try to seek out the holiness, to strive to grow, to strive to connect, to make the decisions. You know, sometimes we're so afraid to make decisions in life because we think we're going to be wrong. And you know what? Very often we are wrong. But better to make a wrong decision than to make no decision at all. Because to throw my hands up and to say life is too ambiguous, I can't decide, one thing is guaranteed, is you'll get nowhere. At least if a person has the courage to make the decision, even if it's wrong, and even if I end up taking 5 steps back, at least I had the courage to move my life, try to move my life forward. I have to regroup, I have to make another decision, I have to try again. That's okay. That's what happens in the post-prophetic age. And herein lies the fundamental message of Megillas Esther. Life is shrouded with ambiguity. Life is shrouded with doubt. Things are often not what they seem. But A, have the courage to make decisions, even if it's going to turn out that they're going to be wrong. And number two, even within the most ridiculous and ambiguous of circumstances, always try our best to seek out HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to try to establish that relationship, to try to pay attention to the details of our Yiddishkeit, and to try to advance and to build a meaningful relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. We'll stop over here for today, and Amir Tzvi will continue with the Megillah a little bit more next week.